this is Dr. Jay Davidson from drjdavidson.com. Thank you for joining me on the Mitochondrial Summit. My guest is Dr. Tina Moore, and we're going to be exploring training your mitochondria. But before we do, a little bit about Tina. Dr. Tina Moore is the owner of Core Wellness Clinic in Portland, Oregon. She has been there for over a decade, or has been practicing for over a decade, and specializes exclusively in the application of natural pain solutions, regenerative injection therapies, and non-surgical pain management for orthopedic and musculoskeletal conditions. As both a board-certified naturopathic and chiropractic physician, she brings a unique perspective and expertise to understanding pain and orthopedic conditions. Dr. Moore is also a number one best-selling author, podcast host, and speaker, and educates physicians as well as the general public online. You can check her out, drtina.com. Dr. Tina, welcome to the Mitochondrial Summit.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here and to have an opportunity to just visit with you again. It's been a long time.
Yes. Well, I have to give you props. I've got in PRP injections in my knee. My wife has as well, too, in her abdomen area after the old, good old diastasis recti of having a kid. I've got Prolo injection knee-wise from you, too. And then I also have to give you props that you've been such an influential person in my life for the importance of strength training and specifically squats. So I was excited when you're like, let's call this training your mitochondria. I'm like, I can only imagine where we're going.
Yes, I'm so excited. So I love strength training, and you were kind enough to have me way back when on your, I think it was a video series you were doing on YouTube and your podcast, and you had me on talking about squats and building strong gluteal muscles. So that was kind of the beginning of a lot of things for me. So I want to thank you for that.
Yeah. Well, it's, we're all in this together, you know, learning and forging forward. So I guess diving into the topic of mitochondria, where does that fit in with exercise? I mean, what does exercise do for the mitochondria?
So the first thing is, and I'm sure your audience by this point knows what mitochondria are, but in my head, you know, they're bacterium based. They're not actually of humans. So when I was an undergrad, I just geeked out on them. I was like, what? This is amazing. And there are powerhouses of our cells. So my thinking was, over the years, as I've gotten older and I've gotten more into strength training and the science behind it, I realized, how do we make more? You know, a lot of talk is about how to make what you have better, because so many of us have poisoned our mitochondria to near death. I think that is the cause of a lot of chronic illness. I remember hearing a physician years and years ago say, how do you know if someone has adrenal fatigue? And we all were like, well, this and this and this. And he said, because they're in your office, period. And then he said, how do you know of those who have mitochondrial dysfunction? And we all paused. And he said, everyone, every one of them, if they have adrenal fatigue or low energy, they have mitochondrial dysfunction. So my thinking was, okay, so we can ramp them up with supplements. We can try to recover them with different techniques, but how do we make more? Right? Like, how do we actually build more mitochondria? And I think really the only way to do that, one of the, you know, most obvious ways is to build more muscle, right? It's the only organ we can grow. We can voluntarily work it and grow it and train it. And then we actually can make more mitochondria. So that's kind of the first one, which is like mind blowing, yeah. You know, when I figured that out. So
I mean, essentially then the more muscle mass you have means the more cells you have, because you have more muscle. Every muscle cell then has mitochondria. Is that the gist?
Yeah, it's awesome, right? So that's something we have control over, that we can, you know, and for the audience too, who doesn't know me, who don't know me, my background is that I really did suffer from a lot of chronic illness myself. So the things I'm telling you and sharing with the world are really from my own experience. Like, this is the great comeback. And I've built myself up over the years, as I've watched you do, you know, I mean, both of us have put on a ton of muscle, and it didn't just happen overnight. So, and with that came improved health and other biomarkers. The other thing is that many people are exercising in a way that's actually poisoning their mitochondria. And we can get into that in just a second, but beyond poor lifestyle, like smoking, drinking, overeating, junk food, you know, totally skimping on sleep, toxicity, which we can't totally control. I mean, we can control the toxicity in our homes, EMF, all of those things are mitochondrial poisons. Fluoroquinolones, which are commonly prescribed antibiotics like Cipro and Levaquin. I know that was like the hot thing to prescribe everybody when I was an undergrad, so took a ton of it. It actually targets and kills your mitochondria because they are somewhat like bacteria. So that's no good. And then how do we build them up? Well, the popular things we're hearing about: intermittent fasting, adequate sleep, and then certain ways of training, particularly. So adding muscle to your frame is one, but also how you train is another way. And we can dive into that really quick if you want.
Totally. So, I mean, essentially I look at kind of trends and I see where it used to be like, how skinny can you get? Now I feel like the new skinny is actually like, I don't even know how you would say it, but like a muscular fitness. What's your take on the evolution of kind of weightlifting, not just, I guess even in the female gender too, because I feel like that's an area that you've just pioneered and been so awesome at.
Well, I think that there is, unfortunately, you know, there's a big difference between bodybuilding and strength training. I'm always going for strength and power because strength and power have biochemical improvements and mitochondrial improvements, whereas bodybuilding basically just makes really weak, inefficient muscle. I want strong, efficient muscle because I don't want to fall down and break a hip when I get older. Like, my goal is longevity always. Okay. And then to be able to be training until I'm in my 80s and 90s, right? And if I'm 90 and I want to go hike the Great Wall of China, I want to do that and not be stuck in I'm sassy. I don't want to be told what to do. So I get really mad when my body tells me no. And I've spent so many decades sick that I've heard a lot of no's from it. So I think a lot of people confuse the two and they try to like build big glutes and build big muscles. And I think that video, you know, I'm glad that we did that video years ago. We actually talked about some of the health benefits, but people really are often just bodybuilding for aesthetic reasons. And that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about actually building strong, powerful muscle that contracts and has good control and good power behind it when you need it, because that's how you're going to stay efficient. Unfortunately, the trend right now is like SoulCycle, Orange Theory, and I'm not trying to call it any main names. It's just that type of exercise, CrossFit, all of those types of exercise are super metabolically costly to people, especially people who have had some level of chronic illness. I know this summit is for general wellness, but I know your audience is, you know, you've made a huge impact in the Lyme community, and I've even seen some of your patients. We don't want to tax those systems so hard in those types of patients. Those people are already chronically inflamed and chronically fatigued. And if we add exercise that just tanks, you know, we used to think like that boot camp style for me was just so metabolically costly. I'd be dead on the floor. And I always thought it was just my adrenals. It's not just your adrenals. It creates such a massive amount of lactic acid and adrenaline that work together in a perfect storm. And they actually create a ton of free radicals and reactive oxygen species, ROS, as you know it. That stuff literally disintegrates your soft tissues, your cartilage. I just had a big post about it on Instagram. I'm doing a whole series actually right now on, you know, all the things that destroy your joints. It destroys your muscle tissue and it completely obliterates your mitochondria. So people who think they need to get back into exercise and they start going for running, like long distance running, or they go to Orange Theory, or they go to any of these very metabolically costly type course or group classes or whatever. While it's exciting that they're getting back to exercise and I want to high five them for doing that, it might be very much the wrong thing to be doing. And it might be costing them a lot and causing a tremendous amount of soreness and pain. If you're really sore after a workout, you are not working out correctly for your body. And you're probably creating a lot of trauma to your mitochondria. So if that's all that people get from this interview, I hope that's helpful.
So what would you say is like an ideal exercise regimen then, if we're going for strength training versus just kind of like the aesthetic or cosmetic, you know, put muscle on type thing, which usually is the classic guy thing.
Totally. And women too. I mean, that's just like weak muscle to me. It's the difference between like, you know, a good cut of meat and like fake meat, basically. So I'm a huge fan of the Strong First kettlebell system, and I'm not affiliated with them in any way. I just have really loved their system because I think it's accessible to anybody. I've seen people come in there of all different ages and of all different weights. I've seen people who were morbidly obese, who hadn't exercised a day in their life or in decades. And I've seen it cause such tremendous transformations. I go to a kettlebell strong first gym, and I have for years. That's where I learned to strength train. And I just the transformations I've seen in people have just been incredible. So I'm a huge fan, and I started really geeking out on the literature that the guy who Pavel Tatsuin is the he brought it from Russia. And the thing I love about it is women in Russia are also encouraged to be strong, you know, culturally. And actually, he said in one of his books, the majority of physicians back in the day in Russia were female, which I thought was really cool. So I'm a big fan. And he has talked in recent years, he has synthesized a lot of mitochondrial research that's coming out of Russia. So a lot of it's in Russian, so we can't translate it. And he has translated it into basically some quick and simple facts, which line up beautifully with that kettlebell system, which is short bursts of powerful output for no more than 15, 20 seconds, and then you rest. So kettlebell swings, anyone who follows me on Instagram knows I'm a total geek of kettlebell swings. Also the 5x5 training you and I have talked about, heavy lifting, 5x5, yep. Same thing, right? It's no longer than, how long do those five reps take you? 15 seconds?
Yeah, not very long. And I guess the purpose too is it's easier on your joints, right? So it's not so much repetitive.
Yeah, and then you rest. So what that does is it stokes your mitochondria and it stokes your central nervous system in a really beautiful way. If you go beyond 20, women produce less lactic acid, so we can do a little bit longer, like 20 seconds. So for most athletes, 15, 20 seconds. But it also allows for rest, which I think is really approachable for most people, right? Most people can like hit it hard and then rest. This is different than high intensity interval training. We don't actually want to go past the 15, 20 second mark. Once you get into the 30 second mark, lactic acid starts to double itself every 10 seconds. So we don't really want to go into the 30 second mark where like that whole glycolysis and aerobic pathway, that's what we're trying to avoid. We're trying to avoid these long aerobic states, or like in CrossFit when you do 30 burpees or 3 minutes of burpee or whatever, you know. It's not only is that going to destroy people's spines, but over time, but it's really metabolically costly. So these short intervals, it lines up perfectly with what you and I talked about in years past, which is that 5x5 heavy, but also it's about power and generating power, which stokes and helps regenerate and generate and build mitochondria, which is amazing. And then you get a rest. And I think that makes it very approachable for people. And then also just to finish that idea, you can do as many sets as you need to, or as that you can, right? So maybe you can only do 3 sets, or maybe you can do 6, but it's totally dialable for people. And I think that's the beauty. You can dial it via how intense you go, meaning how much power you generate. You can also dial it by the size of the kettlebell that you use. So this is something that anybody can access. Even people, I think, who are in wheelchairs or who have not great use of their lower bodies can work their upper body or vice versa. So big fan. I think that it's a simple system and it works and it's approachable for everyone at any level. And so I encourage people to seek that out. Again, no affiliation. I'm not trying to sell anything. I just, over the year, many years of practice, I'm like, I need a system that works, that I trust, that I can send any type of patient to, and they'll get results without totally tanking them out, you know, or making them hurt worse. So
does the shorter reps for shorter time frame, then that limits the lactic acid essentially kind of crazy increase, which then will limit the soreness the next day or later that day or the 2 days later. So for an exercise standpoint, you want to lift and you want to, you know, I don't want to say throw some weight around, you know, shorter reps or smaller reps, smaller sets. But then that's actually going to limit the soreness. Talk to me about that.
Yeah. So the soreness is actually coming from a couple things that I just mentioned. But so you know how we have those little hydrogen peroxide packets in our cells, the little lysosomes, and they explode when they need to clean up the cell or when they need to kill the cell, when the cell's overdone and it's like time to go. The little, I call them suicide packets. That's what I always called them in school. Lactic acid induces those. You can only have those induced in an acidic state. So lactic acid induces your lysosomes to which starts to cause a tremendous, it's not the lactic acid that causes the soreness, it's the lysosomal activation. And then on top of it, you get adrenaline going because you stress the person out and you stress the system out, usually doing this sustained, like crazy amounts of exercise, like boot camp style. And so that's when you start to get all these free radicals produced and adrenaline, and it all synergizes into a hot mess, basically. So that's a sure sign that whatever you just did was not for you and that you need to dial it down or you need to switch up what you're doing. And okay. So we don't want to make people, my thing is that I have people who are in chronic pain or, you deal with patients who are chronically ill. We want them exercising, but we certainly don't want to turn them off, right? Like, it's so terrible when you hear them say, like, I'm a month in and I'm in so much pain, I can't see straight. I don't want to do this anymore. Like, we don't want that. So trying to find ways around that. That 5x5, what we mean by that for the audience is sets of five with five repetitions in each set. So it's, five lifts, rest, five lifts, rest. And the rest periods are important. They should actually be lengthy. They shouldn't be super short. We're not trying to do some kind of Metcon. Like, this whole Metcon thing is the worst thing for people when they want to generate power and longevity, because ultimately we're going for longevity. So yeah, so it fits up nicely with the 5x5 heavy lifting, but it also fits for people who can't do that or who don't have access to that. They can do smaller kettlebells and they can learn things such as kettlebell swings, and different exercises that are ballistic to some degree, but are short and sweet. And then there's a nice rest period in between.
What type of exercises can you do with a kettlebell? I always, anytime I think of a kettlebell, I just think of the swing. And I know you've been a big fan of deadlift and squat. Maybe what else would you put in there outside of kettlebells that are good, like functional strength movements for people?
Well, you can squat for sure. And it's a nice squat because it's a goblet squat. So it's in front of you, which creates a counterbalance. So that's a nice, I think most people can do goblet squats. People who can squat can do a goblet squat, which is much easier than a barbell squat on your spine and on everything. So goblet squats, you can do deadlifts with them if you get a big enough bell for sure. Although I see people starting with small bells, they're just trying to get the hip hinging patterning going, right? The whole thing is have control over the movement, then load the movement with weight. That's the goal, right? We want to have control and then we want to add weight. That's why they can start with little tiny. I started with little tiny kettlebells. I was in the gym the other day and I watched a woman doing a Turkish get up. That's another great exercise. It really requires some coaching, but she was doing a Turkish get up with her shoe. And I was doing one with a big 16 kilo. And she said something to me, or she like looked at me and kind of said something like, I could tell she was feeling insecure. And I was like, lady, I started the same way like 3 years ago. It's or over 3 years ago. Like, we all have to start somewhere. And I started really skinny and weak and sick and had to build up too. So Turkish get ups, swings, snatches, cleans, where you rack it up to here, you swing it up. But I would highly encourage people to seek out coaching for this so they don't hurt themselves. Really easy to hurt yourselves. But once you have it, it's a really wonderful training tool that you can use at home. You can travel with it. I throw one in my trunk and when I go on road trips. Seriously, I can work out anywhere. Well, no, it's more like sanity. Like, it keeps me just kind of, it's my flow state, it's kind of meditated and it's something I can do for a few minutes every day that keeps the anti-aging benefits going and keeps me mobile. And I have a lot of chronic pain. And if I don't move every day in some way, it doesn't have to be heavy, but if I don't do something, I hurt and that really sucks, and then my mood starts to tank and the whole vicious cycle that comes with chronic mitochondrial dysfunction. So
essentially in the Turkish get up, that's essentially where somebody's laying on the floor, they're holding a kettlebell out in front and then they have to get to a standing position with it, right?
Yeah. It seems really simple, but it's super hard.
Multiple steps to like move arm here, move leg here, swing here, stand, Yeah, definitely agree to the coaching side of it if you're going to do that. But that seems so functional, though, that it's something that will benefit your body, especially as you age, that you're going to be more agile and less likely to get injured and be able to do the things you still want to do as you get higher in ages or years.
Totally. I have a quick story. I don't know if I shared this with you. I don't think I've seen you since this happened. I was at a concert that was like very much an age appropriate concert. Everyone was in their mid 40s. And as we left, it was getting dark and I was walking across the street and I thought I was walking across a road divider, but it was actually like a ditch, drain ditch thing. And I stepped in it and went all the way down to my thigh. Like I fell. And as I was falling, the curb on the other side of this divider was quite high. And I saw my face going into it. And I looked up for like a as I was falling, I looked up and saw my boyfriend and his face looked just like yours. Like, oh my God, my girlfriend's face is about to be, I mean, I was about to smash my entire face into this curb and I caught myself and I pushed out of it. And like, I mean, I literally like went, I mean, the curb came right to here and I pushed out of it at the last second and I stood up and I had a huge hematoma on my thigh where my thigh hit the curb. I hurt myself, but like I was all shook up and I was like, oh my God, thank God for strength training. Because I looked around and I looked at all the people coming out of the venue that were my age. And I guarantee you 99% of women in my age bracket would have just been in the hospital. Like it would have been very bad and there would have been teeth missing. And I had a big event to go to. All I had to do was have a bruise on my thigh that no one could see. But I just thought like, oh my God, thank God I've been doing all this work all these years, because I think I would have just shattered in 2 million pieces. So yeah, the Turkish get up, like people can't get up and down off the ground very well. It's crazy. And then if you fall, how do you get up? You know, most people don't even know. Most people don't even, honestly, as they age, they don't practice that. They don't practice getting up off the ground. They just roll out of bed and go from chair to chair to chair without any consideration that they might wipe out someday. And like, how do you catch yourself? How do you roll? How do you, will you bounce or will you shatter? And I just don't want to shatter. So.
Yeah. Well, it becomes a liability, you know, essentially. So I guess, is there an ideal, so if somebody's going to strength train or they're going to dive in, you know, to kettlebells, is there an optimal amount of days per week? How long does a workout take you? You know, if you're doing more heavier weight and smaller amount of reps and sets?
Well, I have found that I really do need to warm up. I used to not warm up and then I ended up hurting myself. So I'm a big warmer upper. I think as you age, or if you have any long history of chronic illness, you're probably pretty glued together, you know? So I think it's really important to make sure you have an adequate warm up that lasts anywhere between 10, 20 minutes. And then my workouts are pretty fast. Sometimes I just do 10 minutes of kettlebell swings and a few get ups and it takes me all of 20 minutes. I think that doing something every day is important, even if that's just a walk. And I think that doing an actual strength training session or where you're being, you know, pretty metabolically engaged, maybe 2-3 times a week is max. So for someone just starting out, 1-2 days a week is a wonderful place to start, but you want to be building towards more. We obviously can't go full bore I'm true testament to that. If I go full bore on something, I just hurt from tip to toe and I flare everything and it's a nightmare. So like, we got to ease into this. But if they can't access weights or kettlebells or coach, again, disclaimer, hire a coach so no one gets hurt, because we're both chiropractors and we don't want to see anybody blow out their joints or their disc. But if that's not accessible, I think even just taking exercises like on a rower or I wouldn't suggest sprinting outside because there's a high likelihood of falling, but even on a treadmill, even just taking a treadmill and ramping it up all the way, like full resistance and full, full incline and hitting that for 15 seconds. So you're doing high intensity interval training, but you're doing your on intervals are short and sweet and your off intervals are as long as you want. So that's a wonderful way for people to start. And that's something anyone can do. If you can get to a gym, you can, and I've done that when I'm particularly sickly or feeling unwell or just generally like in a decline or in a flare, I'll just go hit the treadmill on full incline, full resistance, 15 seconds, huff it as I'm walking, I'm not running, 15 seconds as hard as I can. And then I just jump and I hold onto the rails. I jump and stand on the sides and I just let it go until I feel everything come back to reset. And that might be 1 minute. It might be 3 minutes. And I might just tootle around and then I hop back on and do it again. I might do 3 rounds of that. I might do 8 rounds. We don't want to go with that kind of thing. We don't want to go more than like 10, 15 minutes max. So it's just 8 rounds in there, little warm up, 8 rounds off. That would do huge things for people. But don't make those intervals. The mistake most people are making is they make those intervals like 30, 60 seconds long. really long, intense intervals. We just want short and sweet, hit it, kind of stoking the fire.
Okay.
That's how I think of it. I'm just trying to stoke my nervous system and stoke the fire. And then I get off, I rest as long as I want, hop back on, do it again. And then I'm out and I feel great.
So it's almost like short, quick workouts, but being consistent that you're continually moving the body, and that long-term is what you see optimal.
Yes. Cause we got to stoke the mitochondria. I think of them as the little burners. There are little, it's a little like, what are those, accordion things that you stoke the fire with, but that's what I think of it as. It's like, I need to pump that every day for a few minutes to get my mitochondria to come back online and to be robust. And it's really apparent to me, if I go a few days without doing that, I start to tank. So when you say I'm hardcore, it's not because I'm trying to be like super fit and have a great aesthetic body. Cause I have body fat. Like I'm 45. I'm not trying to be like Miss Bikini Body, but man, I just don't want to feel crummy anymore. You know, I spent most of my life super sick, and it was actually after several rounds of Cipro. I'm pretty sure I got floxed, and that's why that was the beginning kind of the end for a lot of things with me for many decades. And then to come out of it, it's been a journey and an experiment on myself. And then I work with different patients and see how they do. And this seems to be something, again, very approachable for people. And I learned about this originally from a 400-pound woman who didn't want to be 400 pounds anymore. And I helped her lose hundreds of pounds. And she taught me about high-intensity interval training. And then I adapted it to these short, sweet intervals, because most people can't do that hardcore Tabata, you know, high-intensity stuff. Like, they can do these small incremental. I didn't know why, though. I just knew it was accessible and doable because I could do it without tanking out, but I didn't realize the science behind it until, you know, I just had to keep researching to put it together. So,
yeah, well, you've helped me put a lot of pieces together, because you've, you know, a few years ago told me about the importance of building muscle mass, that essentially when your immune system needs, you know, life, it's going to take muscle, break it down, use amino acids, and, you know, kind of activate the immune system. That's one of the pieces. And then I started really looking around at those with chronic illness. And it's amazing. Even somebody that looks like, quote unquote, fit or, you know, ideal body weight or even skinny, but yet it seems like they didn't really have muscle. You know, anyone mm-hmm. that's in the chronic illness, it's like they lose muscle mass. And then doing some research in the last year or so, seeing that mitochondria play a big role with immune system like activation and directing, then I started thinking, like, wow, just it all connects. And now you're, you know, of course, saying the easiest way to build your mitochondria is to build muscle, or, you know, get more mitochondria to build muscle. So what are your thoughts on all those pieces?
I love it, because you're right. It all goes together. And I think muscle is so metabolically active, and we don't even have a clue how many things it's doing. We haven't looked at it. You know, we haven't looked at the science really hardcore. Some of these Russian studies, if I could translate them, I would love to, because they were figuring this stuff out in the 80s and 90s. Like, this isn't new. We just wasn't embraced. In fact, some of this stuff came out over half a century ago and nobody jumped on it, you know, at the time. And so I think that, just to back up, when you're in chronic immune activation mode, you go into cachexia. I think that's how I stayed so lean for so long. I thought I was thin. I was just chronically inflamed and chronically cachexic. So the minute that slowed down, I actually put on some weight, and I was like, where did this come from? I'm like, that's because I chilled out. It's because I changed my life around and closed my practice and like chilled out. And I finally was able to build strength and muscle and actually put on some fat, because I was living, much like cancer patients, they will get into chronic cachexia, which is muscle wasting. It's the beginning of the end. Aging causes sarcopenia, which is also muscle wasting. It's actually poverty of the flesh. That's what its root word is. And then thirdly, when people are in chronic metabolic syndrome or diabetes, which is what the bulk of our country, even people who are very thin, are thin on, we call it tophi. It's like thin on the outside, fat on the inside. They're metabolically obese, but they're very thin in stature because they don't have much muscle mass. It's all fat on there. It's just not a lot of it. Those people have a terrible time building muscle in their legs and their arms. So they'll get central obesity, but they'll have think about all the people walking around with guts who have skinny arms and legs. They're actually in a chronic cycle where, because of their insulin resistance, they can't build muscle on their arms and legs very well. And if without the muscle on the legs, they can't get over the insulin resistance. So it's like this horrible vicious cycle that they need. And I hate to make it so simple as insulin resistance, because I know it's not just that, but the key is we have to reduce inflammation. We have to work on building muscle, which reduces inflammation, by the way, because it secretes myokines, which are anti-inflammatory, which is awesome. So we need all the things, and we got to do all the things, and we got to have a good nutritious diet, sleep, all the things, right? All the things we talk about all the time. Detoxing, you know, coffee enemas. You reminded me of those a few years ago on my podcast, and I was like, oh my God, yes, I forgot about those. Those are amazing. So...
yes, it's just tools, right? Tools in the toolbox. It's almost like strength is the new skinny.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's absolutely not negotiable if you want to have any kind of anti-aging regimen in your life and longevity. And if you don't want to fall and break a hip. So.
What role do kettlebells play with like grip strength? And what role does grip strength play with like longevity and just overall health?
That's such a good question. I'm so glad you asked that. Sometimes when people can't do anything, I tell them just to buy a 16 kilo kettlebell or 12 kilo, pick it up and walk around their house and put it down. And then I tell them to switch hands and pick it up and walk around their house and put it down. Okay. And my coach taught me that because it stokes your nervous system. Like it's really good for your central nervous system, but it's also good for grip strength. Because we need grip strength, which is severely lacking in our society, particularly in women. I see it. I teach injection courses for doctors, and I see all the time the limiting factor is they don't have any grip strength. And grip strength has been shown to be an independent risk factor for early death, so or lack of grip strength. So we know that. We know that in the studies. And you have to have good grip strength if you want to have longevity. Same thing with sitting down and getting up without touching the ground. You know, you cross your leg, however you want to do it, but crossing the legs, sitting down, and then being able to get back out without touching anything is also another independent risk factor for early mortality. So both, you know, getting up and down off the ground with ease and being able to grip onto something with strength are both really good ways to improve outcomes and longevity.
I had no idea with grip strength. I was just thinking, I mean, because when you're, you know, kettlebell around, I mean, it seems like the limiting factor sometimes when you're lifting isn't the weight as much as can you actually hold on to the weight. Like not the actual push or pull the weight, but can you actually hold it, grip strength. So it seems as if grip strength is important in strength training, but
it's super important for life, you know, and it's my assistant and I joke, we call people with really poor grip strength zombie bait because they're... we're all going to run away and they're going to be down there trying to get up and they can't hold on, you know, even if you have strong leg muscles, you have to be able to grip onto things and pull yourself up. So yeah, it's wild. And I'm not saying any of this to put fear into anyone. It's just a matter of like, make it a priority. I really am a big fan of hiring a good coach because they'll hold you accountable. And this isn't a mamsy-pamsy investment in yourself. This is a really good return on your dollars. It will decrease your pain significantly and will improve your longevity and your overall health and wellness in ways that you have no idea. I had no idea. Strength is a superpower. I had no idea until I got strong that I was like, wow, this is like some next level Jedi stuff that most people are missing.
Yeah, well, I'm all for like empowering people at home, but I love the idea of having a coach for, you know, strength training, because it's like, if you have the wrong form, that can be so devastating to your structure, to your body. And I mean, that's where you get injured and you're like, oh, I can't, I was going to stay on this good regimen. Now I'm injured. And now you're looking to, you know, repair when it could have just been the form. If you would have fixed that or had somebody say, well, you know, really you got to engage the hips first, or, you know, all these things with squats and all the other type of exercise, it just takes a lot. So as we wrap up this, any other final thoughts that you want to jump in on with strength training, the power of it, kettlebells, mitochondria? I feel like this is just such a motivating interview to get out there and start throwing some weight around.
Yeah. Well, first and foremost, look at Strong First, because I feel like it's a very safe system and approachable for anyone. And there's group classes available. So it's something that is affordable for most people. So that's one of the reasons I like it. Safety is their first priority. It's not like, you know, it's a crapshoot what you get at the gym with a personal trainer. We know these guys are like some Jedi level stuff. Secondly, I would say that never underestimate as well the power of what strength and conditioning can do for your mindset and your mental attitude and your fortitude and your grit and tenacity. Because I think often with chronic illness and chronic pain, it's so depressing. I've been there. It's just such a doldrum and you can't get out of it. And what this can do as an antidepressant, and just like, really, it translates into everything. It translates into my attitude about everything. It translates into my can-do-ness. Like, I look at things without fear anymore because I'm like, oh, I can do that. Even mentally, like, I can take on a mental challenge and have the fortitude to do it. And so I think that that's equally as important in longevity. We need good brain strength as well as physical strength.
Love that. Totally agree with that. I'm just thinking about, since really being serious in the last few years about, you know, strength training and being pretty consistent at it, that I feel my mental strength has probably improved even more than my actual physical strength has.
Yeah, for sure. 100%. Don't you think that your success in the last few years has everything to do with consistency and strength training? I do.
Totally.
Like, you cannot be a strong and successful entrepreneur without having the physical fortitude and mental fortitude to handle it. So for me, like, it's been such an equal, like, as I've gotten stronger physically and mentally, my success has risen. So I think it's kind of a non-negotiable for entrepreneurs as well. Little pearl there.
Yeah, just putting the pieces together. Well, I want to thank you so much, Dr. Tina, for coming on to the Mitochondrial Summit and sharing your wisdom. It's just, love your energy, and you know, you're just right to the point. Like, get strong first. So
yeah, awesome. Thank you. And I have a chapter in my book. My book is free, and there's a chapter all about strength training and all the science behind it if people want to read that. So
cool. Yeah, they can check out drtina.com to get that. I want to thank you for listening to the Mitochondrial Summit, and make sure to share this interview with your friends and family. And also consider adding this summit as well to your library by clicking the order button. And don't forget to visit Dr. Tina Moore at drtina.com. Doctor is DR and then Tina is TYNA. So drtina.com. Maximum blessings. This is Dr. Jay Davidson.